is freely in the cargo hold of the space shuttle. He's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand. He pushes the barbell, the 200-pound barbell, to the north at 1 meter per second. Action and reaction. His body will move 1 meter per second to the south. They'll spread apart because of his muscle action, and because the weights are equal, they'll spread equally. If he did the other way around, if it was a 1,000-pound barbell and a 200-pound man, as he pushes on that barbell, 80% of the motion will be his body, and only 10 or 20% of the motion will be the barbell, if you know what I mean. Well, in your case, when you're feeding that quarter-wave ground plane, the antenna and the transmission line is trying to suck some electrons out of that counterpoise and shove them into the radiator section. Well, if the counterpoise is a...
He's turning that to a half-wave vertical instead of a quarter-wave.
Hey, sir, Joyce. We haven't gotten there yet. I still got to tell him what's going to go wrong with this one, but Eric's got some words on this. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, well, let's just talk about what he had. I just looked up what the fire stick antenna is. And it is a 5/8 wave antenna, so it's basically it's a learning coil on a stick, if you want to think of it that way.
Okay, I'll first tell you what happens with quarter wave. With quarter wave, you'd like to have a great big ground plane. And if you don't have a great big ground plane, the ground plane moves more than the radiator, if you know what I mean. What you think is the antenna really becomes the ground plane if the ground plane is too small. In the case of a near half-wave diameter radiator, when you feed the outer end of a half-wave dipole, you're now feeding thousands of ohms, and therefore the requirement for the ground plane becomes much, much smaller. You're drawing much less current out of the counterpoise and shoving it into the antenna by way of the transmission line. The transmission line is a kind of an electron pump in that particular situation. So because your fire stick is something like 5/8 wave, what you're doing with that sheet of metal probably will work. If it was a quarter wave antenna, it wouldn't work very well. But in many of these situations, the best thing to do is to try it and measure the standing wave ratio. With rare exception, it's not going to catch on fire, it's not going to explode. If you've got the wrong amount of counterpoise, you just get a slightly less efficient antenna tuned to the wrong frequency, and it'll give you a high standing wave ratio. When in doubt, we amateurs are very good at being experimentalists. Just go and try it at KD2KNL, K2RIW, the TechNet. You got it, Ed.
Yeah, KD2KNL. What I was thinking, is there a way I could, now I'm going to call them aerials, because I don't know much better, or radials. Like maybe put four pieces of metal or wire coming out from that ground plane a certain distance to make it work better.
That's the Cadillac approach. If you put two, three, four ground plane radials, and each of them are electronically a quarter wavelength long, and that's the grounding system, so to speak, for that antenna. Now you're going to get the most ideal performance in the world. Because a quarter wavelength of wire, open end at one end, at the end closer to the antenna becomes the short circuit end. And so those three or four pieces of wire can act like a very big sheet of metal. In your particular case, quarter wavelength is around 8 feet. So if each one of those is 8 feet long, two, three, or four pieces of wire 8 feet long will give you almost the same performance as a sheet of metal 16 feet in diameter. You've made a skeleton radio equivalent of a great big sheet of metal just by those three or four white pieces of wire roughly 8 feet long. I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense at KD2KNL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, it really does. Now, just a question on the wire. Can that be like a stranded wire, or does it have to be a solid wire? Because I'd like to make this thing portable, so I could set it out on the... This is just a test thing, you know. It's not an antenna I'm going to have permanent set up, but I'd like to be able to just set it up and maybe spread it out on the dining room floor and then... Could it just be stranded wire? Does that make a difference if it's solid or stranded?
In this case, solid or stranded makes very little difference. There's lots of various kinds of wire that will work very well. the resistance of the wire is all that you really care about, and a little bit of RF characteristics, the so-called skin effect. Stranded wire might actually work better than solid wire in this particular case because there's more surface area for the skin effect of the RF. The radio frequency signal, when it hits a piece of copper, only penetrates down into the piece of copper about a 1/10,000th of an inch. That's all it does, the skin depth, they call that. Whereas if you and I were feeding a DC voltage from a battery through that wire, the current would be flowing through the full depth of the wire. The radio signal only flows on the surface, the first 1/10,000th of an inch. So you see how stranded leads have more surface area to the first 1/10,000th of an inch. So in this case, stranded is probably better. Therefore, you've got a very portable antenna that you can easily wrap up and ship to another location and then deploy. Back to you, Ed, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KD2KNL. Okay, thanks very much. So what I'm looking at is four pieces of 8-foot long wire coming out from it. And is there a certain way I should mount this to, so I have this maybe 10, 12 inch diameter dome, let's say, as my basic ground plane. Is there a certain way I need to mount this, or just put them, the four pieces spread equally around it?
When you look at the pictures in the book, you'll see that the four pieces of wire are all spread out exactly 90 degrees apart, all straight pieces of wire on a flat surface, and the antenna is mounted in the middle of that, and it's on a flat piece of land on your backyard. That's the ideal picture. You'll be amazed how much you can get away with. Each of those four pieces of wire don't have to be exactly 90 degrees apart. Two of them can be 120 degrees apart. The pieces of wire don't have to be super straight. Some of them can be curved and zigzag a little bit. It's the electrical length of the wire that does most of the work. The exact layout that make it completely symmetric to your eye, the RF is pretty blind. It doesn't see those details. And whether or not the ground plane radials slope away from the antenna, because the antenna is mounted a little bit higher and they're not on a completely flat surface, that's, again, a very minor detail. You've got a lot of variations you can make here to install this in your living room, so to speak, and make it fit even though the living room you think is not big enough. The ends of the wire of the ground plane radials, they can curve up, curve down, curve to the left, curve to the right. It's their electrical length that counts. And the exact physical layout is very secondary in this case. Give it a try, and most likely you're going to be pleasantly surprised, Ed. And even if it doesn't work perfectly, there's a couple of tests we can tell you about to find out what's going on, so you know how what the next step is of making it work better. It's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. Over to you, Ed, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the information. Just one last question. The insulation, as far as the insulation on that wire, does that make a difference? I think you mentioned it before, but I didn't quite grasp it. If it's insulated wire, will it still work, or do I need bare copper wire?
Yeah, that question is very similar to the guy who's deciding to build an 80-meter dipole, and he's building it out of 14-gauge household wire. And he asked the question, should I leave the rubber insulation on or take it off? And the answer is, it doesn't matter. The RF energy goes down through the rubber, which is an insulator, until it hits the metal, and then it does its thing. Now, you might want to leave the rubber on in the case of an 80-meter dipole because it'll weather protect the copper wire, and you get less copper oxide. In your particular case, leaving the insulation on the wire makes it a lot nicer to coil it up when it comes to transporting it. I would leave the insulation on the wire. The insulation is, if you measure the effect of the insulation and not the insulation on a piece of wire 8 foot long, approximately 8 feet long, you're trying to make it a quarter wavelength at your operating frequency, 10 meters in your case. And if you ran the experiment with the insulation on and insulation off, and you tried to tune the wire, let me drop it. You try to tune the wire, each one of the four wires for exact resonance. You may discover that with the insulation on the wire, you will hit resonance with the wire being 1 inch shorter out of the 8 feet because of the insulation. As you can see, it's an extremely minor effect. So whether or not you leave on the insulation, you're making that choice for physical reasons of keeping the wire together so it doesn't kink, so you can easily roll it up, so it looks pretty, and so on. Radio-wise, the insulation is almost not there. Back to you, Ed, K2LIW.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm going to play him hand a little bit. K2RIW, KD2KNL, thank you once again, 73.
Hey, you've got some good questions here, Ed. Come back periodically and let us know how your experiment is working. Even if it's not working, let us know. Next person on our list is Rich, N2EO. All the things in the Massapequa Park. You've got it, Rich, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. And Tuio, and pretty soon if things work out, I'll be coming in on Echolink from Kennebunk Estates in I forget what county that is. I'm going up this Wednesday with Barry and a whole bunch of others to take a look. It's Sutherland County, I probably just remember it. What I wanted to know, Dick, from you or anybody else, are these mobile homes that I'm going to look at, are they usually constructed with aluminum siding or vinyl siding? If they're aluminum, I may have a problem. I was given permission to put up a dipole, or if I want an inverted V, and my current 2-meter 440 vertical. I wanted to know also if I put it up as a V, or have Barry put it up as a V, what you suggest to anchor the ends? To get my anchor into the ground, because maybe earth screws, but earth screws are meant for a... meant for a more of a sturdy thing, not just a couple of wires. I'm going to bring it in like I have now with ladder line. What do you know about that, Dick? Or maybe somebody else knows. And I'd also like to know, I looked on the internet, I haven't found a radio club in Sullivan County, but, you know, I'll keep looking. Maybe I just haven't been looking in the right spot. There are people that go up there to vacation, to hunt. If anybody knows a good radio club up there, I haven't found one, but... also, I have DMR here. If there's somebody who has a DMR repeater, that would be nice. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, you made it sound like whether or not the trailer is made out of vinyl siding or aluminum siding, you think it's going to make a big difference in your radio performance. I think that makes no difference at all. The majority of the antennas that you're going to be using are thoroughly balanced antennas. Like your current antenna you use on the HF frequencies right now is a thoroughly balanced center-fed dipole-like structure fed with open wire line. So the current you draw out of the right side of the dipole is the same current you push into the left side of the dipole during this half cycle. And whether that inverted V dipole is mounted above a vinyl trailer or an aluminum trailer, no difference in the world. The kind of antennas you've been using lately are relatively light pieces of wire. You don't need anything as near as substantial as an earth screw anchor. The kind of a squiggly piece of metal, it's a spiral piece of metal that's used for anchoring a dog in the backyard. It looks to me like it's about 3 foot long, 4 foot long, a squiggly piece of metal, and you screw screw it into the ground in order to connect the leash of your dog. That would be more than enough at each end of your dipole on your inverted V, and those are very easy to install, very easy to buy in any pet shop. Let me drop it. You're not trying to build an antenna that's going to survive 140 mile an hour wind, if you know what I mean, Rich. And so that is a quasi-earth screw anchor. If you don't have any local trees, fences, and other poles to use as an anchor point for your dipole, you've got to go bring everything back down to the ground. That, in my opinion, would be more than substantial enough. Whether or not there's any ham radio clubs in Sullivan County, I'd like to believe there's a website, and QRZ.com or whatever will give you some information on that. When I pass it back to you now, Rich, drag your feet a little bit in case somebody knows of a ham club in Sullivan County, the place where you're likely to be going to, if I understand you correctly. N2EO with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment?
Go ahead, comment.
E2FIU, George. Just to support what Dick was saying about the anchors or augers that you might need, they're generally 22 inches long. Half of it is about a 2-inch diameter screw. They're rated at 125 pounds pull weight. And they are available in pet supply stores. They're for big dogs. Cheap. I don't know if they're $2 or $3 a pop. Another thing is, I make contacts directly in the Catskills with the that nationwide repeater network. I actually hit it at not in Ellenville, but it's in Sullivan County. I forgot which town, and I'll ask some people, and I'll report to you, Rich. I catch you on this repeater once in a while, but I do talk to people up in Sullivan County on 2 meters from the QTH here occasionally. I'll report that to you, but the dog augers are excellent. I use them myself, KD2FIU.
Okay, I thank you, George. Good information. I think I heard Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
No, I just looked it up. There's a Southern Sullivan County Amateur Radio Club. It's not called that. Let me get back to the right page here. It's called the Southern Catskills Amateur Radio Society, Sullivan County, New York. Or SCARS, SCARS. And they have a bunch of repeaters there, so you should be able to be on VHF and UHF without a problem. K2RWK, do that.
Okay, I thank you, Eric and George. Good information. See if Rich needs to fill in any of that. N2EO. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, Dick, that was good information from George and Eric. Excellent. Dick, the reason I was concerned about the siding is because the dipole is going to be running very close siding by the time it gets to the ground. See, the reason I'm going to this place called Kennybunk, we're going up there Wednesday, myself, Barry, and a few other people to look, is because they'll allow me to have the antennas, and above one, I can even keep the dog. So they're very liberal. Good, Dick.
Okay, good luck with that project, Rich. I wouldn't worry about vinyl versus aluminum siding. The transmission line properly installed, it doesn't see the environment. The antenna itself doesn't see the environment. As long as your trailer is not a metallic structure that hits resonance. If it hits resonance, it's going to change your antenna pattern a little bit. Big deal. Very unlikely. So I think you can stop worrying about that. Next person on our list was Joe. WHYYY. Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Joe. And I'm sorry to say, I didn't hear your call letters coming in earlier. Apparently you were trying to check in earlier when the other people were checking in. WHYYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
And the first thing I'd like to know is what receiver am I hitting when I'm talking to you? Because I tried transmitting earlier, and I kept the mic even depressed, and you didn't answer me.
I only answer the people whose call letters that I hear. And it wasn't until the tail end of all the check-ins that for the first time I heard WHYYY say to me, "Hey, am I getting in? Are you hearing me?" And from that, from the way you worded that, I had the impression you were trying to check in earlier, and we didn't hear you for whatever reason. And, normally I set my receiver so that I'm hearing the input frequency at the same time that I'm on another radio hearing the output of the repeater. I forgot to do that tonight. I wasn't monitoring the input frequency tonight. I goofed on that one, Joe. Sorry about that. W2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Are you set up like that now? Okay, well, it really doesn't matter. My question is actually very simple. The motor on my circulator for my heating system is starting to make a hum because it forgot the words. The question is, this thing's about 25 years old. Is this a telltale sign like the motor's starting to go? Because making this hum is connected to all the heating pipes. So I just noticed this about the past 2 weeks or so, where it's very noticeable. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm hearing you very well on the input now that I've reset the receiver correctly. Normally, I monitor the input of the repeater at the same time that I'm getting people to check in. So you're hearing a loud hum of the motor, apparently that you've never heard before. And my experience with motors tells me that when they develop a shorted turn in one of the windings, they start making some loud hums. In the case of testing a starter motor for a shorted turn, they put it on a machine that presents a magnetic field, and they call the machine a growler. If there's a shorted turn, the
repeater, timeout.
If there's a shorted turn, then the magnetic field they're trying to induce into the armature or the field will make this growling sound. So one shorted turn of a motor creates a huge disturbance to the magnetic field that's trying to flow through the motor on each half cycle. And when that shorted turn is there, you do start hearing a loud hum. On top of that, normally when the motor is running into that kind of a failure mode, it will run at a higher temperature. But the current is flowing through that shorted turn, it's going to create some extra heat. So for you to measure the temperature of the motor would be another clue. When I listen to my oil burner, I do hear a fair amount of hum over all the years that I've used it. So it could be something that's always been there, Joe, and maybe just taken recent notice of it. Then again, maybe you have been keeping good track of it, and maybe the noise has suddenly increased by 10 dB. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
When's the last time the motor was properly oiled?
I don't know the answer to that question about the motor being oiled. I don't know that. Probably several years ago when I had a service by an oil service technician to get a cleaning. That's many years ago, probably six, 7 years ago, maybe more.
There's little ports on either side of the bearings, usually like in a circulator. You got to fill it with oil to the top. Check that, maybe dry. I apologize for butting in. This is WA2PJF in Bayshore.
I thank you for the information, Vito. Good information. I think, I believe the recommended procedure is a couple of drops of oil into that oil tubing on a motor. A couple of drops of oil once or twice a year. Is that approximately what's required, Vito? Back to you, Vito.
Yes, that sounds about right. But however, you can fill it to the top and put the lid on, a little flapper. There's no problem. But it should be checked. But the bearing could be grinding, for one thing. I'm only guessing. I'm not familiar with that was with motors. But I know that lubrication is very important, especially for the bearings. So just a thought. It can't hurt anything. Look at the motor. Any little pipettes, little openings for oil can be put in. Put the oil in there. Any kind of oil, even motor oil if you want. But oil has to be put in there. I don't think 3-in-1 is a good idea. Probably motor oil. Back to net.
WS, to answer. I'm hearing another station signing in. We'll kick you up in a minute. And WS2N also. There's a very specific kind of long-lasting oil sold by places like Sid Harvey, the places that sell you the components for oil burner service. They have a very specific kind of oil. It comes in a container which is about 2 inches in diameter and about 4 inches long. It's got a skinny piece of plastic tubing coming out of the top of it, which fits very nicely into that oiling hole of motors. That's a kind of oil that's known to last a long time and does a good job. 3-in-1 oil might not be the recommended oil for this application because it has a drying out characteristic. I'm going to go to WS2N and then the other person in that order. Paul first, WS2N, K2RAW. Go ahead, Paul.
Burner motor? What is he talking about? It sounds like he was talking about the motor and pump that's the circulator for his hydronic heating system. I'm just trying to figure out which one he's talking about. Back to you, Dave.
When it comes to, by the way, Paul, when I passed it over to you, you didn't wait for the beep. You picked up immediately. Lucky we didn't time things out. There is a coupling mechanism that goes between the motor and the squirrel cage blower and the pump mechanism. That pump coupling mechanism, I've had it fail, and that's a replaceable component. That coupling mechanism, I think it's about 3 inches long. It's got a D-shaped hole on each end. And so that coupling mechanism is a kind of vibration isolator between the actual motor and the squirrel cage blower and the fuel pump. So I suspect the possibility is if you're getting a failure of that it could be off-centered and give some funny vibration. So I presume it was the motor of the oil burner itself that is giving you this extra hum, not one of your circulator pumps. But correct us on that, Joe. W2RYY, wait for the beeps. K2RYW in the TechNet.
I initially said circulator motor. I didn't say burner motor. It's absolutely the circulator. I only have one of them for the whole two zones. It operates for either one. It's a circulator motor. It's very small, actually, in size. It goes between the pipes, between the inlet to the burner and the piping system for the whole house. So it's not very big in size. I've never tried to take it apart. The only thing you can probably take apart is a cover where the wires go in to power it with 120 volts. But I don't know if I can actually get at the motor assembly itself without, you know, totally disassembling it, and I don't really want to do that.
Hey, George, the green one?
Light green, like lime green.
That's the takeoff motor. Just take it, throw it out, and get another one. They're great motors, though. They do last forever.
HUC, we're going to pick you up in a minute. EJ, yeah, go ahead first, Derek.
Alright, I was going to ask if there's a Seiko cartridge motor, because that's a bit unusual. If it was a B&G, like a lot of the older circulator motors with Bell and Gossen, they actually had a starting capacitor, and when those things leak, the motors just do weird things and make an awful lot of noises. But if it's a Seiko and it's a cartridge motor, four screws pops out, you don't worry about water leaking or anything like that, because the impeller is separate from the motor itself. And you pop a new one right on. As far as it making hum, yeah, I can see that's possible with a whining short, but I've never run into it. Keep drawing WK2 again.
It seems like it's a sealed unit. However it's put together, I've never seen the screws be able to take the motor assembly apart out of the housing.
Well, Pecos are typically black. They're perfectly round. They have a little flange at the bottom of them.
Okay, another person who wanted to give us some information was Mr. HUC. Give us the full call. Mr. HUC, go right ahead. K2RW on the TechNet.
Yeah, it sounds like Joe's describing the cartridge circulator pump. The one thing that he can try to do is leave the zone. If he has a bit of air in there, they tend to get very, very loud because they're water-cooled bearings instead of the oil-cooled like the gentleman was describing earlier. If not, if the thing is 25 years old, you just replace I would replace the whole thing because there are you could try and just change the motor, but there's also a bushing behind the impeller. It's not really worth, you know, messing around with. 25 years, he's got his life out of it. Just change it. It's much easier than screwing around.
Steve, good information. Steve, what's your best guess as to a small circulator motor? Roughly how many dollars is that replacement? KD2HUC, K2RIW.
You can get a replacement in a Home Depot. I think they're about $60. Some of them have a built-in flow check, which if he has zone valves, he won't need. So, and those are a little more pricey. Just your basic run-of-the-mill cartridge circulator should be about $60, and they're relatively easy to change. The only thing is that if you don't have isolation valves on both sides of the circulator, you're going to have to, you know, drain the system, change it, and then fill it back up. So it's not terribly difficult. It's just just a little bit of labor.
Thank you, Steve. Don, good information. Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
The motor is who actually makes the motor? I don't know what I can do with the thing. I'm not in a position to replace it right now. That's what I just asked the question. I don't want the thing to crap out on me in the next 2 months or so, if possible. But if it sounds like that's the indicating that motor itself is going bad because it's maybe given like an internal shore on a winding or two, maybe it's time to answer my own question. Maybe the thing might be not long for this world. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we're going down the list of everybody who checked in. We said they had a question or a comment. Thursday was certainly a very nice snow day here on Long Island. I got around 12 or 13 inches worth of snow, and the health of my snowblower was very important because I've got a 90-foot-long driveway that's two cars wide. That's an awful lot of snow to shovel if I had to do it by hand. And that particular snow, I discovered, was very sticky stuff. My goodness, it kept jamming up the intake auger of my dual-stage snowblower. And no matter what I did, I couldn't stop that from happening. I just had to basically give up as far as all of the snow blowing on Thursday night. And what I was going to do is to dry out the snow blower completely and spray it with a WD-40 or PAM in order to make the surface more slippery. But I didn't get a chance to dry it out. And thank goodness for me, the snow characteristics overnight between Thursday and Friday changed. And so the snow became much more crystally and icy, and so it went through the snowblower a lot easier on Friday morning. And keeping the carburetor properly clean on a gasoline-powered snowblower or a lawnmower, that's an art and science in itself also. How you drain the bowl and make sure that no fuel is left, which can jam up some of those very fine orifices. And when some of the very fine orifices inside of the carburetor spray bar, when they get jammed up, you end up with a reciprocating internal combustion engine, which will continuously be cycling between high speed and low speed. You never get up to full speed, and it's always cycling back and forth. The carburetor becomes very unhappy, and to take that apart and clean it is a little bit of a pain. And to find something, in my case, to find something small enough to clean out those very small holes in the spray bar, I had to take apart a piece of 18-gauge stranded wire and take individual strands to use that as a poker into these very fine holes. I don't even think a number 80 drill would fit into that hole, if you know what I mean. I wasn't able to find my number 6280 drill, so I ended up poking it with a piece of wire. There is a website which favors Tecumseh engines and maybe Briggs and Stratton engines. There's a website that gives you a lot of blow-up pictures of carburetor maintenance of these small engines on lawnmowers and snowblowers. And so keeping that carburetor clean and making sure you've drained all the fuel out of it the last time you use it is something pretty important. Anyone have any further questions or stories about their snowblower operation over the last few days, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
About the electric snowblower.
Now, in the case of an electric snowblower, I don't think anybody runs a battery-powered electric snowblower. Most of the electric snowblowers are quite often one stage and not two stage, and you've got this great big long cable behind you, and you got to worry a little bit about you're standing on a wet surface, so if anything goes wrong with that system, everything is not double insulated. It represents a slim possibility of a shock hazard. You got to be very careful to keep track of where the cable is to make sure you don't suck that into the snowblower. However, I've heard of people using an electric snowblower on Thursday evening because we had a very warm day before and the soil was very warm, so the beginning of the snow hit and melted and then refroze. And so you ended up with this slushy kind of a snow that would easily jam up either an electric or a motor-powered snowblower. And that jamming up of the auger by way of this very slushy snow sticking to everything was the real problem, I thought. Maybe you didn't run into that, Wes. N2XJN, how well did your electric snowblower work? K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW with a comment.
Yeah, N2XJN. Let me see if I can do it. Okay, it's Snow Joe, ION24SB-XR. It's 80 volts. You're going to have a 5 amp hour, 6 amp hour batteries, 2 batteries in each. It is 2 stage, has 3 speeds forward and 1 speed reverse. And I happen to buy it. And what I can say about it, great. But great only if you have a spare set of the batteries. Usually it can operate about 1 hour with 6 amp hour batteries, which is plenty enough. It does have, if I remember correctly, something that is amazingly and quite difficult to leave, 1,000 pounds per minute of snow into a tree.
WS2N.
Very fine. We've got Mr. HUC and S2N in that order. WS2N. Sounds like you bought the right machine. So completely portable with that battery operated, 3 forward speeds, very nice. But only 1 hour's worth would not have been enough for me. And yes, you have to have a spare set of batteries to plug in while the other set is being charged. My guess is recharging the batteries takes a couple of hours. And so, although then again, maybe a couple of hours of rest in between your first stage of snow blowing and your second stage, maybe that's the right way to do it. I don't know. Let's see what Steve's got to say. 82HUC, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
Yes, Ed. Actually, when it comes to small engines, a mechanic gave me quite a tip as far as not having problems with the carburetor like you're describing. This, the biggest problem is with the gas, with the ethanol content, and it tends to heat up and destroy the carburetors, gel up and do a whole bunch of other nasty things. So he pointed me in the right direction. They actually sell ethanol-free gasoline for small engines. It comes, you can get it either just plain or pre-mixed with two-cycle engines. But it has no ethanol in it, so it doesn't do all the nasty things that regular gas from the pump does. I've been using it for two seasons now, and it does make quite a difference. I haven't had any problems of any sort with any of the carburetors on my equipment. So I highly recommend it. You get it in any of the small power tool places or Home Depot. 82ACC, back to net.
Interesting. That I didn't know. Some people will put this material called stable into the fuel, and that supposedly stops it from gumming up. But ethanol-free gasoline. Huh. Roughly how pricey is, what's the expense of that? A gallon of that costs how much, Steve? KD2HUC, K2LAW.
It wasn't too ridiculous. I want to say probably like $6 to $7 per gallon. That was for pre-mix. I haven't bought the non-pre-mix since the beginning of the season, but it was comparable. You know what? For the aggravation it saves, even if it's twice the price of a regular gallon of gas, does it matter? You know what I mean? As long as when you go to start the engine, it starts. I'd rather pay the extra, you know, $2. But yeah, I didn't know it either. He pointed it out to me, and he was right. 82 ACC, back to that.
Thank you, Steve. Good information. Ethanol-free gasoline for small engines. How about that? So it's the ethanol that gums up, not the petroleum itself, or its additives. Huh. And so I wonder if this substance that people put in called stable, I wonder if that somehow cancels the ethanol gumming by some magic process. Let's see what Paul's going to say. WS2S, K2LAW. How much snow blowing did you have to do, Paul? You got it.
That's quite a bit. And the sterilized, I use that. I put it in the gas tanks, I put it in the lawnmower, put it in the generator. So, yeah, I like that. One statement I wanted to mention was the cleaning tips. You could go to Home Depot or General Welding, or any place that has, sells stuff like that. I got noise on my speaker. 1 second. Not sure what that's about, but you can get these torch tip cleaning set, you know, from very good size diameter all the way down to something fine. You can barely even see it, and they're made of steel. And then as you put them in, you know, it's got a rough edge to it, and you can clean any kind of small ports. And you just get the kit, you know, it's probably, you know, a couple of dollars. But I have them. I've used them before. And, you know, lawnmowers. And the other thing, electric snow blower. I like it because it doesn't take up hardly any room in the garage. I have that. And I have the one with the cord. But once you get used to the cord following you behind as you just keep walking forward, no problem. And it's easy to just grab the cord and just give it a flip, and on the way back you don't ride over it. I've been using that for quite a few years now, and it's excellent. Plug it in. I like the battery idea, but like you did, my property's too big. It would never last. But I know with the big 80-volt batteries that they have. He's got Sunjoe, that's a very good company. So, that's my comment. Back to you, Nick.
It's removed work.
What was that, Wes?
Usually when I do something that was also with Kenwood 2000, half of a year I just take the internet, talk to the people, and try to find out the best of the best for the cheapest possible price. It is nice, slicky, rigid. The price is $899. Actually, I think with the 6 amp-hour batteries, you're going to pay, and the tax, you're going to pay a little bit less than $1,000 for it. It does drive by itself, so you're not pushing it. You just put one of the drives, when you go back, you actually go to the reverse, and it goes by itself in the reverse. Now, it is really giving you that 1,000 pounds per minute of snow. And quickly, it's doing the job. But the problem is the batteries. When you the batteries are dead, you wait approximately 3-4 hours, and you still see that the batteries are not fully charged. So if you have investment of another $350 in the batteries, then yes, think about 1,000 pounds of snow times 60 minutes times 2 hours. Send to Asia.
I think you said that a spare set of batteries are around $150. And so, from what you know, Wes, what's the amount of time it would take to remove the spent batteries and plug in the auxiliary set of batteries? How long do you think that battery switch would take? And you already did tell us that a healthy 4 hours of recharging is required. I guess if this is the best of all worlds, if you got a very, very big piece of property, you'd want 3 sets of batteries. And I'm guessing these are lead-acid batteries, fully sealed lead-acid or gel cell batteries. Isn't that true, Wes? WS2N, K2LIW.
No, it is not. They are 40 volts, 6 amp hours. They have a 5 amp hours in the original offer. You buy 6 amp hours. Lithium ion battery. They're supposed to give you an hour, 58 minutes, hour. Now, the 5 amp hours give you 40 minutes. Changing the battery takes less than 30 seconds. If you have a glove, it takes 40 seconds. Enter a chip.
Yeah, lithium ion is a very nice set of batteries that the people who fly radio controlled model airplanes, battery operated, that's what they're using, lithium ion or lithium polymer, I'm not sure which. But you get a lot of energy density out of lithium, but they're a little pricey. And you've also got to be careful about charging them. The people who are using those kind of batteries on radio-controlled model airplanes, when they follow all of their rules at their competition, the batteries must be in something like a gun case while they're being charged to protect from a potential explosion or outgassing if it happens to happen. So if you've got one set of batteries in your house being charged while the other set is being used, you want it to be super safe, they should be put into some kind of a sealed container while they're being charged. I suspect very few people do that. I wonder if the instructions recommend anything along those lines, Wes. WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet.
The manual actually warns you to probably charge those batteries. And be careful where you place the charger. That's good. But from the other hand, okay, you have 1 minute, 1,000 pounds. 60,000 pounds per hour. 60,000 pounds, 30,000 kilos. How much snow do you have on your vehicle? Hendrix here.
Please, the big stupid idiot!
Yeah, my particular snow this time was approximately 12 to 14 inches deep, 90 foot long is the driveway. I'm guessing 25 feet wide. So I could calculate the number of cubic feet, I could calculate the number of pounds of snow, and with something like a 9 horsepower engine on my 24 inch wide snowblower, I think I took approximately 2 hours to clear that space. Part of that time, of course, was because of the snow jamming in the machine.
How wide is the path?
Something in the vicinity of, I think around 20, 25 feet wide, 90 feet long.
So this one is 24 wide and 13 inches deep. That's the diameter of that dual action plate or something.
Yeah, but I could calculate the cubic feet and make a rough guess as to pounds per cubic foot and so on. So, quite a lot of snow in my particular driveway. So, clearing that all out, I think I would need 2 full sets of batteries to do that, Wes. Go ahead.
Yeah, you can go to YouTube, and in YouTube you go to Snow Joe, but you gotta. They have different ways. This one is the most advanced one. Go to that ION24SBXR, which is 80 volts. The guy shows on one of the videos comparison between gasoline engine and the snowblower. He also states that the gasoline one was used before, but when you look at how clean is the driver driveway after just one run over, you're going to be shocked. It does have adjustable shoes, so you can go very low on it, and also it gives you special instruction if you have a gravel, how to adjust it properly. But actually, I didn't feel tired at all. It runs by itself. So yes, it's not that I'm trying to give it a good recommendation. It's my experience. I spent the money, and I don't regret it. And to achieve. Oh, one more thing. The guy was, the video was 5 minutes, if I remember. Within 5 minutes, the guy was able to show about 3 meters, 9 feet wide pathway, driveway, whatever it was, clean up. I told you.
Yeah, I'm guessing that an electric powered, battery powered snowblower is a lot quieter than mine. The person who had the question, it sounded like the voice of Vito. Whoever that was, go right ahead, K2LAW in the tech net.
KD2FIU, it's George. Hello again, and question for Wes. Very interesting what you're talking about. A question here is, if you need to shut, need to turn around or readjust your direction, are you better shutting off and restarting again? Because I believe restarting draws a lot as opposed to keeping the motor running. So, for example, if you're going to turn it around and you need to do it for 15 seconds, 10 seconds, or something like that, should you shut down? And if you do, does the restart draw a lot again on the motors? Question here.
No, actually, I was going around the poles talking about the sidewalks, there are a lot of obstacles I had, uncollected garbage that they didn't load up to the truck yet, and I was going all around without even stopping it. You could stop it, start it, it's electric motor. It doesn't give you any grief and any problem, any slowdown whatsoever. What you got to understand is that left handle, you have your drive. And the right handle, you have your motor. Now, you can have it automatic, so you have you push the button on the right handle, and you hold the grip. So now it is kind of locked. But the left one, you're not keeping all the time. When you have a 40 inches of snow, what you do only is you go close to it, release the handle, and then you wait till all of the snow go out. Other than that, you're gonna cloud it. So I did with what I've learned, and I'm pretty satisfied with it. I simply go to the pile of the snow. Actually, when I was trying to clean up around the car, this is the most difficult when people park on the street. You actually go close to it, and you see that all of that snow with pieces of ice flowing in the air. So you got to be careful to not damage other cars. And all you got to do is, you're going to the high pile of snow because it goes by itself. You just release the drive and let it consume the snow and throw it out, and then you just push it a little bit more and it goes like that. And to here.
I think you had a question, Paul. Go ahead.
It's the way he described it. That's perfect for the use in these areas, but the additional question here is that as you drop and repower, does it drain the batteries more than if you let it running at RPM?
As I deliver physics, if you don't have a load, it doesn't draw more. You start to stop. What you're gonna have? Just the initial startup. That would be just to make it rotate. This thing does not rotate fast. It is not like a torque that you have to overcome. And by that, you're using more power. No. What do you think about it, Dick?
Thank you, KD2FIU.
As I see it, George, you're worrying too much about the rotary mass of the motor assembly. The majority of the current drain of Wes's snowblower, I believe, is when it's chopping into the snow and throwing the snow. It's really displacing a lot of mass of snow. The turning of the motor that just starts up the auger and starts up the flowing mechanism, that's minor. And so starting and stopping there, don't worry about that. The real current drain is when it's engaging the snow and throwing the snow. That's what I think is going on. Do you see it that way, Wes? N2XJN, K2LAW.
That is correct. If we talk about the initial inertial mass of the blade assembly, it is going through the number of gears. So the blade by itself is not crazy going up, and doesn't really require from you to stop it on the torque or start it. We're trying to overcome that initial mass of the blade. It's minor, it's omittable. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it's completely omittable. But when you are in a pile of snow and then you now release it and you're trying to push it in, yes, that might be they use it because now you have to overcome the initial inertia of the blade plus whatever the mass you have on it.